You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're covering Season 1, Episode 5, titled Upon Awakening. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron, what do you think of the fifth episode here?
I thought it was another good one. I will say that there's a few quibbles I have with some of the stuff on Terminus. Actually, some of the stuff on the ship, too, that could be just like maybe plot holes, or like sometimes we talk about how the telling ambitious story, sometimes you just have to ask your viewers to make a leap. I always talk about, like, metaphorically, you got to like go down a couple miles of dirt and gravel road to get back onto the highway. Or it could be that like there is some next level stuff going on that I haven't anticipated. None of these things are plot holes, and it's all going to pay off in the episodes to come. We're only halfway through. That's happened already a couple times in the course of the season. So I really enjoyed it. What did you think?
So anybody who's listened to this podcast over the last 4 weeks here knows that the best part of this show to me is the Empire stuff. And so obviously that is conspicuously missing this episode. I know we're getting back to it next episode because Apple likes to publish teasers for their stuff. So I will say, with that said, that I still enjoyed this episode pretty well. I liked the point of no return sort of analogy they had with the black holes. I liked the trying to extricate yourself from a cult and sort of how that happens that they displayed with Gale. The Anacreon plan seems to be unfolding, even though I think there is another layer to that. I don't think their goal was to crash one of the Imperial ships on Terminus.
No, I mean, the stated goal was to commandeer one. So I was like kind of blown away when it stacked up onto the planet. So
yeah, so I don't know. There's more to come on that, I'm certain. But the other stuff they're doing, especially with Gale, I really liked. I know it's not, you know, it's taking us back in time, right? And some people might look at that as like a step backwards instead of forward. But in storytelling terms, I feel like it was warranted, and it connected me more with this character. So going forward, maybe they can do more stuff with her that I will care about more because of these scenes.
Yeah, I saw that one of the most common criticisms was that, why are we going back and the first 15 minutes of stuff about Gale that we already knew? Because the pilot episode definitely kind of told us that. How would you respond to those criticisms?
I would say we knew the facts, but we didn't feel the facts. There's a difference between intellectually understanding things and emotionally feeling those things happen. And I think as someone who's lived through an extrication, especially you, I think you had a similar sort of experience to Gale coming out of the cult that we both grew up in. That stuff really hit home, and I started to really understand Gale on a whole nother level. Understand, you know, not just that she's a brilliant mathematician, but she's always been curious, right? This has always been a part of who she is.
Right, right. And, you know, how it would be very attractive to her, Harry Seldon, trying to tackle a disaster head on and avert as much human misery as possible through the application of logic and reason, versus her home planet that's burying its head in the water. Rather than confront something.
And I have a sneaking suspicion that in the next four episodes or five episodes, however much is left in this season, her parents are going to die because they both stubbornly refuse to come with her, right? Her father said, I'd rather my daughter die than go with you.
I mean, at this point, they're probably dead just from age.
Right. Like, and 35 years on. Yeah, I guess. Yeah,
you wonder.
Because she was saying, like, this is an impending doom, right? This guy is prophesying all these. I don't know if it was the change of the seasons or what, but yeah, there was an incoming devastation, an incoming problem, let's say crisis, that this society was refusing to deal with, just sort of placing their faith in their seer sleeper god. Now I'm sure that's gone off. I'm sure her parents are dead. I'm sure that's going to weigh on her. But we'll see.
To the extent, I wonder if we'll ever see Synax again. Like, they went back and told the tale, and we already saw, like, how... I mean, I thought they did a pretty good job of showing how, like, the landing platform is underwater for the Imperials, something they probably don't bother to keep up or elevate. Because they just assume the world just completely isolate from everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if we'll ever go back there, because you're, like, why would Gale want to? Because it's just going to be her, you know, drowned world and dead parents. But
I didn't get a sense of the scale of that society. I don't know if, like, the impending catastrophe was going to wipe out just their small raft flotilla. I don't know what it is. It's a city on stilts, I guess.
Right.
Much like a house in Florida on the coast.
Sure.
I don't know if that's all that exists on Synax, or if that's just a small portion of the population there, and the rest will be still alive and fine.
Hard to say. I mean, they do say that the severe hurricane force winds and the resulting, like, tsunamis and flooding is going to... I mean, it seems like Gale doesn't think there's any amount of... But on the other hand, her college professor said that eventually the flood waters would recede and we could save them. So, like, I don't think it's hopeless exactly, but yeah. But yeah, so it's like, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ponder the fate of Synax going forward, because the whole galaxy seems fixed to fall apart. So
yeah,
I've got some things, some announcements regarding our show, Foundation and Podcast. We were able to procure screeners recently, so we're going to be able to start getting our full coverage podcast out the same date and time the episode release, which just means whenever the episode releases on Apple TV, the podcast will pop out on our website. So as soon as you get done watching it, you can enjoy our thoughts and comments on it. And to keep it all fresh and relevant, that means we're going to split the feedback off of that podcast and release something on probably the following Tuesday. So we should have, like, you know, like you should have regular Foundation coverage. You got the date and time on Friday, and then midweek you got your Foundation booster shot on Tuesday. And then we'll keep doing that throughout the season. The other thing is David S. Goyer graciously agreed to come on our podcast and talk about his show and answer any questions that we might have. That's going to go down this Friday. If you're hearing this, you only have a couple of days to act. So if you have a question, I have a request, send it to foundation@baldmove.com. Make sure that Goyer is in the subject, because come Friday morning, I'm just going to search for this. It's Goyer, G-O-Y-E-R. And just put whatever questions or comments you want to make. And I can't promise get it all to him, but I will try to get as much as I can, along with our thoughts and stuff. So I'm really excited. I've been listening to the official podcast with him and Jason, and various, writers and showrunners, on the show. It's been really informative, and, it's going to be a lot of fun talking to David, I think. So
still the possibility that this is a very elaborate troll, but we'll see.
It would have to be. It's increasingly elaborate. I guess. Well, I guess we'll find out on a Zoom call.
We will
see if the man behind the curtain is actually a wizard.
Yeah. All right. Let's get started with the recap. But first, let's take a quick break.
The Vietnam War. It's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
We start off before is what they're now calling this. They don't even give us a time frame. They just say before. Mm-hmm. It's a flashback to a baby being baptized. And in this case, it's the seer religion, which means it's getting its stones put in its face. I wonder how that works as they grow in age, but okay.
They stay the same size. They don't like upgrade them. They're just like these little teeny,
yeah, teeny gems. So they get smaller, I guess, in relation to a human.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the same? Isn't that the true about our eyeballs? Like our eyeballs are exactly the same age.
Is that why babies look like aliens when they're born?
It might be like their heads disproportionately. But I heard like the eyeballs are the one things that don't grow.
All right.
So maybe not. I don't know. Don't quote me on that.
Gail still has her stones, so we know that it's before. Mm-hmm. And two others along with her are sent to investigate a condemned university, and they find an instructor removing some of the analytical books, forbidden knowledge. She begs him to leave those books behind and go before he's found and killed. And while he tries to convince her the whole time that there's something to all the science stuff, and eventually the others find him, he's taken back to the tribe and the religious people drown him. And then later that night, Gail swims down to his body and takes the analytical texts that he was killed for and begins studying them.
That's a big chunk.
I know.
That's I'm about to chew that for a minute. I love, first of all, like this show looks amazing. Mm-hmm. I want to say it a lot, but like this opening scene of this just jaw dropping space porn, where Gail is kind of having her nightmare about the black hole swallowing her in the form of a tidal wave on her planet. Mm-hmm. That just sun, their sun shining through their planetary ring, and it just, god dang, in 4K, this show looks amazing. But I like the, you made allusion to this in the, your comments in the introduction or your thoughts on the episode, the way we wove this, recurring nightmare that Gail has, this fear of the black hole because of the event horizon, the fact that you can, you know, take one more step and then there's no way to reverse course, mm-hmm. Obviously is a commentary on what she's found herself into, now, like, she didn't know it at the time, just like an astronaut is getting closer and closer to the wonders of the black hole will probably not feel when they begin to get spaghettified. She did not know at the time that she was signing up to be put on a 35-year-old cryo coffin when she filled out a math contest for Trantor.
Yeah.
But she did. That is actually, that was the point of no return when she, and honestly, offering one to the dudes 50 clamshells to send a message off world, that was the first. So
honestly, I think diving with who she is, I think diving into the ocean to grab those books is the point of no return for her.
There you go. And like I said, it's a content, you know, you don't know it until you've crossed it. I thought right. That was a pretty good way to get us back, you know, like to get us back in. And I feel like I'm continue to be impressed by how well Gail's narration is kind of like supporting the themes of the episode without feeling it at least doesn't come across to me as like being too highfalutin or too like high concept. It feels right.
Yeah. And no, I'm with you. All these episodes have had that, thematic connection, and it makes it richer, I think.
And there's all these things that she gets to hold on to, like, you know, after destruction, there's going to be rebirth. And what is the thing that leads you from the state of destruction to the state of rebirth and creation? It's knowledge. And I think, you know, if you subscribe to the theory that Salvar Hardin is the love child of Ra'sh and Gail, then this cycle of destruction and rebirth is literal, you know, like out mm-hmm. of this death of Harry Seldon and the death of Ra'sh, you have this special child that's born. I thought that stuff is really good too.
Yeah, there's so much in here thematically to talk about. I love the sort of reversal of typical tropes, because a lot of the times in movies or TV shows, you'll see the arcane forbidden knowledge being of the magical variety, right? Where it's like,
right.
Oh, they're experimenting with the dark arts and it's, mm-hmm. you know, going to open a portal to hell. And then you got Event Horizon, mm-hmm. the movie. But in this, it's totally reversed, right? It's like the religious people are the ones who are forbidding this knowledge. The arcane knowledge here in this case is math and science and actual knowledge. It's just an interesting, you know, flip flop of that. And also these, the mathematical knowledge has near magical powers, right? Through psychohistory. Right.
Fortune telling.
We would not call it magic, but it is extraordinarily powerful predictive powers. Yeah. And then also the concept of like the truth having nothing to hide from investigate or nothing to fear from investigation, right? I think is ultimately like the thing that it is trying to tell you here. And that anyone who would have you ignore or have you limit your knowledge has something to hide and something to fear. And that is dangerous.
Oh, 100%. I also like a lot of the symbolic stuff they're doing here, like when their mentor holds out this theorem scroll to her and they're like, take this. And she's reluctant. He goes, I'll hold it for you. And that turns out grisly when he's actually at the bottom of the ocean and she has to get it from being tied to him. And also, I thought so on the official podcast, Goyer and the crew were talking about how they wanted, you know, the method of execution would be this person weighed down by their, you know, heretical texts, you know. But I couldn't help but notice if that's the goal of the seers, it also reveals an underlying hypocrisy because it ain't the sacred text that weighed this man down. It's the three fucking stones they tied to him.
Right.
So it's like
it's their baggage, not his.
You kind of get it, you know, but both ways. Like exactly. It's the weight that they added to him that is causing him to sink, not the knowledge itself, which I thought, I don't know if they intended that or not, but I thought it was great.
Yeah.
And also just the weird affect of these people coming in this man's execution, smiling, joyful, like it's I forget what she said, becoming like your father, pious and pious and looking for hair, you know, always looking for heretics. And her father is just like, you know, got this big smile on his face. He's so satisfied that they're doing this righteous thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sickening. You know,
it is. And then that underwater garden of bodies is a macabre display of ignorance that is
shocking
and horrifying at the same time.
Yeah.
Especially, look, none of this is like super heavily veiled metaphor with what they're doing with climate change and, you know, hurricanes and high winds and just shit like that. It's all happening today, too. And that's what makes all of this sticking your head in the sand and refusing to believe, trust in the science and believe in knowledge as our savior here. That's what makes it all the more horrifying to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That we're repeating these things on, it's the exact same fucking thing that's happening right now. Yeah. And just like you saw that, like, you know, Gail's trying to point out facts of the matter, like, you know, it's been really warm and her dad's like, you know, I have to go out further and further to get the algae blooms. And, you know, Gail's like, maybe those two are connected. And her mom's like, no, it's monsoon season. You and how many so times close. Have we seen this just a few years ago? We had a senator bringing a snowball onto the Senate floor and being like, where's the global warming? There's still snow in Washington. Checkmate, scientists. Like,
right.
This is literally the exact same fucking bullshit. Yeah. So, and of course, the idea, if you followed the production of this show, this is something Goyer and company have been working on for 4 years, you know, like it was a long time to get the series sold and in pre-production and then a COVID hit. So this is not like, you know, this is something this is almost evergreen. You could have made this plot anytime the last 30 years, but holy hell, are we literally going to get to the point where the water's at our doorsteps before we do something? And of course, by then, probably going to be too late.
Yeah, you'll have to weather a little destruction to get your rebirth at that point.
Did you so Gail untied her professor, Mr. Soren here. Do you know why? Or was she what was she untying from him? Because like I feel like I was waiting for him to float up and that was gonna be the thing that gave her away or something. But like she unties him and then so maybe like is each thing tied to him separately, maybe?
I think so, because she had to tie it. I think the rocks were already tied before she tied the book to him, and
she had to take the heresy and add that to it. Okay. Yeah. All right. Because at first I thought she was untied to do, I couldn't figure it out. And I'm like, well, if she unties him, he's going to float up. I know
probably
how bloated corpses work. I've seen I've seen enough Sopranos and The Wire to know how these things go, but
sure.
Alas, that's not what happened.
So then later she's eating with her parents and she's concerned about, like you said, the dying algae, as well as their inability to gather supplies to feed themselves. And she's continuing to study these texts, and she pays to send an illegal tight beam message to Streeling University, which we know, of course, is where Harry Seldon is on Trantor. The Seers find out that someone has entered a math competition, and her mother warns Gail to let all of this go. She doesn't, of course. She continues studying. And then she gets a message from Harry that says, you know, some people doubt you, but in an extension here, me. With this Abraxas solution, but he's giving her his support and inviting her to Trantor. I guess we can go through the rest of this too. She tells her parents what she's done. Her father like refuses to support her. She has her face stones removed. This kind of all is just getting back to the point that we first met up with her. In fact, there is the one exact scene that we already saw as they see her off. And this is the point of no return, I suppose, for her.
Yeah, and it's like brings it all home that, you know, her nightmares always end with her drifting towards this miraculous and then not being aware that she crossed the line because she's so distracted, bearing witness to something most minds can't even comprehend. And this is all intercut with her, you know, her reading this and like doing the math on the clay pot or whatever she was doing. It all reminded me of this interview I saw of Bill Gates where someone asked him, this was like, I don't know, 20 years ago. And someone asked him like what he does for fun. He's like, oh, I read calculus textbooks and I just laugh and laugh. It's such a good time. And like her, like I'm a lot more sympathetic to Goyer's take on the podcast. We're like, I sucked at math. I hated math. I was decent at it because I had a father who was a real ball buster and made me do it. But I fucking hated that stuff. I can't. And I've heard some people talk about how much fun it is to play with numbers and how satisfying and beautiful and symmetrical and pure mathematics is. I always thought it was a pure cast iron bitch. So I did not find this material relatable, but also I'm not the type of person who could apply this stuff like she does towards the end of this episode. And they're just, again, it's something they've already told us about how naturally gifted she is for this stuff and what aptitude she has. And the professor told us, and now they're demonstrating it. But I thought it was, pretty effective. Yeah. Do you think, because I was looking at what like all the things that Harry was saying in her message where he was recognizing her as being special, something special about her mind. Do you think that was part of the process of Harry selecting her, that like he knew something about her, you know, the and this goes if whether you subscribe to the Salver is special and that she has a little bit of precognition and whether she got that from Gail because Gail secretly her mom. I know I'm asking some loaded questions here, but like what do you make of that? Do you think Harry, is this part of the plan? The fact that he has someone with these gifts and an integral part of his organization that he's kind of squirreled away, or what do you make of it?
I don't know what to make of it. Gail is not that big of a contributor to the foundation in the books.
Right.
In fact, she's in it very little, at least in that first book that I've read. So we're kind of off the map with Gail, with a lot of this show, which I think we'll talk about later. But I really don't know what to make of this stuff.
Okay. I was just seeing, as you mentioned, at the end of this podcast, we're going to do a little bit of kind of like book versus show versus pacing versus like some speculation. But like you're saying, we're increasingly getting off the maps where like the relationship between the show and the source material, except for the central themes, like I think it's pretty faithful to the concepts and stuff. But for in terms of characters and motivations and the actual outworking of plot, we're getting pretty far afield so far, I think, as an improvement. Mm-hmm. But it is hard to be like, what? You know, when I saw, I was like, yeah, what are they actually trying to get at here? I think I looked this up for the first podcast and I forgot to talk about it, but did you look into Abraxas?
No, I did not.
So they talk about some official podcasts because Jason Concepcion asked Goyer, like, what is the Abraxas theorem? And everyone just kind of laughed like, nah, we fucking don't know. It's a mathematical MacGuffin, like whatever someone in the, you know, the year 17,000 AD or whatever could come up with math wise.
Sure.
But I looked into it and Abraxas is literally just a mystical word, like a mysterious word. From like Gnostic and Kabbalistic origins, that is connected to all this kind of like demonology and mysticism. And I think it literally just it is just like a word that means mystery. So it's almost like the MacGuffin conjecture.
Sure,
they could have called it that, but I don't think there's any there. It's just a mysterious word.
Okay, I mean it's effective. I get what they're doing with it. The other thing I get from all these scenes is how well they capture the experience, like I said, of extricating yourself from a cult, right? This idea that knowledge will set you free. You get the curiosity that then turns into to research or studying, and then turns to doubt, and then it turns to disbelief. And finally, you make some of those hard choices, like the point of no return, right? Pulling out the stones.
Yeah.
For Gale is certainly a point of no return. At this point, she's got a physical manifestation of her inner her inner lack of belief, right? There's no hiding that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like getting an A for apostate tattooed on your forehead in this society.
Right.
And they also think they nailed about it is how furtive and secretive this activity is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, most times when you learn something new and it's something that's like changing your life and blowing your mind, what you can't wait to tell your friends and family. But in these religious like cults or even secular cults, this feels dangerous and scary because it's going to have just the knowledge is going to have consequences in your life. So you got to read it. You got to stay up late at night. You got to go to the library across town. You got to, you know, you got to clear your browser history because it's good practice.
I'm not a cult.
I think it's something that a lot of people can't really, unless you grew up in an environment like that, the concept of forbidden knowledge and that being more than just like your parents kind of might be pissed that you, you know, watch a rated R movie before they thought you, but like, it doesn't really change your life to like, this is, you know, can in some cases be life and death.
Yeah.
So I thought they nailed how scary and clandestine and how isolating it is. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have a chance to bring your family along with you because you have to get it all kind of firmly worked out before you're able to like come out with it. And then you're already a convert and it's hard to. So I thought they did a really good job. I do kind of hope that they visit this planet again, Synax, because I kind of want to know more about like, how did Gale extricate herself from the situation? How did she go from the acolyte of the Seers and in line for third spear of the plant people to getting her stones plucked out and just walking off the planet? Like, why didn't she get the watery? I don't know if they explained this in the first episode.
I feel like this happened in a day. Like, not all the research and stuff, like, that happened over a long period. But then when she takes her stones out, I feel like it's that morning and then she's on a flight out of there.
So who does who does she go to get her stones taken out?
Like, fair question.
That's a really weird. It's like you know, if you went to fundamentalist Christian planet and they had one abortion clinic, that's like, all right, if you're gonna get executed next morning, we'll give you we don't like it, but we'll give you an abortion just before you escape off world. Like, I would like to know, because you know, again, it's not necessary because this is just lore and world building. But I am a lore whore. I am a world building junkie. So I would like to get some answers to that, because where do you go to get the quick stone removal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do you go to get your apostate A branded onto your head that they don't just shuffle you into the eternal fires of damnation right after? It's like, that's the thing that they do to you before they slide you down to the hellfire chute, you know?
So I think there's some implications of what we see in this episode that might lean toward that. Like, this is an event that happened pretty recently, right? The destruction of their civilization, the rising waters. There are people. There's a professor in this episode from sure. that university that's been condemned. This is a pretty recent event that all knowledge has been essentially outlawed. Yeah. I think like that's part of it, right? You can kind of see like there might be another group of people on this planet who are on the fringes, who aren't yeah. part of the seer religion, who still believe in the old ways of the universities and the knowledge.
There is that kind of that gathering. And they even apply that in the first episode, because when Gail's having her stones plucked out, the woman doing it says, you know, some people decide, you know, pray one last time or something like that. So it's like this. Yeah, there is kind of some resistance.
There's a beautiful little touch at the end of this scene where she's getting invited to Trantor by Harry Seldon, and she gets that message, and then she thanks the sleeper, her mm-hmm. her god, for mm-hmm. that. And that to me is like, yes, she no longer believes in this religion. Yes, she's getting out of it, and she's hoping to take her family with her. But there's still that ingrained sort of almost ritualistic acknowledgement of a god within her. And I feel like that is so true to life, right? You get past, intellectually, you get past the religion, but there's still that remnant of it within you that would have you thanking your god for something. And then, you know, maybe catching yourself and going, oh, I probably shouldn't do that anymore. But also, it's still there.
But I also think that, like, that's also, like, a lot of the, you know, great thinkers of our time. Like, you think about Galileo, you think about Isaac Newton, not atheists.
No.
In fact, in their writings is like the study of the natural world was their way of glorifying God. I think mm-hmm. even Charles Darwin denied that he was an atheist. Maybe later in life, he said he's maybe leaning agnostic, but like, and I don't know, but did he, that does like a social pressure. But like I said, with right, Galileo right. and Newton, no fucking way. They actually, you know, believed in God because, and that was the thing that drove them forward. So I don't think that Gail's probably frustrated that she feels like she has to make a choice, and she probably thinks that this in the sleeper's plan, it probably, you know, like she's maybe following the true path. So she's like, I don't know, a little bit of a messianic figure, but I thought that stuff was really cool and interesting too.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the now. Well, yeah, I guess that's now. It says now. We're back to the pod from the end of last episode where Gail awakens and she lands on the ship. She tries to get out of the room she's in until the knife that was used to kill Harry is pulled into the door like a key. The ship activates and she cautiously walks around until she finds a control panel and discovers she's the only one on the ship. And also she is in the future, or what she thinks of as the future. About 34 years or so.
There's a lot of interesting stuff that if you blink, you miss it. Like when the magnetic system snatched a knife out of her hand and it says the mm-hmm. Raish arrival protocol has been initiated.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that I think, and again, this is not book knowledge because this is not in the books, but like I think that Harry built this outpost / ship with some kind of plan in mind involving Raish that mm-hmm. didn't involve him or Gale necessarily, or maybe it shows that he has a whole bunch of different like variables of like, maybe there's a Lewis arrival protocol and maybe there's this or that. But I thought that was interesting. And also, what does it imply in terms of like chaos theory that got name checked in this episode mm-hmm. that Gail is arriving to the Raish arrival protocol.
Yeah.
The man that predicts everything. But like, is that something that he's like, you know, Harry as he's dying is like, make sure you throw your knife into the pod so it'll activate your program because I didn't write it. I think this stuff is fascinating. Like, you know, how do you solve a puzzle when you're missing a piece? And that's what Harry's kind of doing, it seems like. There's some things like he didn't, you know, we already talked about it. He didn't intend to survive the trial. So, like, what other things did he not intend that he had to make a few tweaks? And how terrifying it is that he, you know, he's making these tweaks and then dies and there's no more tweaks to be made.
Yeah.
Like,
or the tweaks have to be made by other people without foreknowledge necessarily. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I think this, leans even more into the idea that, you know, the conversations, the argument that they had in that previous episode between Raish and Harry, that was staged. I still don't think it's certain that that's true, but this pushes it much more in that direction.
Oh, I'm almost, because like, I think that, it just implies like everything. If you think about those first two episodes again, like, how Raish felt until about halfway through the episode when he talked to Harry, and then, you know, he was distraught and talked to Gale about, you know, like, you know, how, because, you know, he was, you know, didn't want to do this. And then Gale's introducing doubt in his mind about whether this is all true, but then he kind of found his faith and did it. I just think that stuff was the idea that he does. That was a last minute change. Like, I feel in my mind, that was like a night or two before Harry died that Raish started acting weird and started interrogating. Like, what do you mean by it? There's missing puzzle pieces and stuff.
Yeah.
I just think that like, that just makes it even more remarkable, like how last minute and how last ditch it was. These change of plans and the size of this facility kind of belies a purpose other than just Gale. Like, what is this fucking thing made for? That's putting her on the slow ship to Harry's birthplace. Mm-hmm. What was Raish supposed to do? Like, if it, you know, was it programmed to take Gale somewhere else? If it detected her, why? So, and also, like, why do you detect this shit on a knife? Like, this magnetic door latch? Like, you know, did it? I don't know.
I don't know. Why do we use our phones to unlock our front doors? You know, it's like,
I mean, but this is a world that they could check her DNA. They could have done a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was I'm just curious about how many more people are going to come. How many more rooms are in this ship? Like, when is she going to get access to more of its features? What is it going to do? When it, like, I mean, these are all things that the show wants you to think of. But I just wanted to run them down so everybody in the audience is thinking about it too.
Yeah, for sure. So they introduced the concept of the Era Imperial in this, which is essentially their calendar. Well, it's not the calendar system, but it's the era they're in on a calendar system, which is most likely not Gregorian. I don't know. It's possible it is, but I don't know how that would be true when you have a galaxy spanning civilization, because our calendar is based on the cycles of our solar system and specifically like, you know, the orbit and rotation of the Earth around the sun. Mm. So it begs the question. Well, that's not the right turn of phrase, but it makes me wonder what a galaxy spanning civilization would use as the foundation, no pun intended, of their calendar system. What do you use? Is it the rotation of your galaxy around some central perceived central point of the universe? What?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've seen it done where like the science fiction author sees it as, yeah, like there's some kind of sidereal time that they're like some kind of absolute, you know, accounting for all motions of the stars and the universe and the galaxy and the galaxy through the universe. And I've also seen things like, you know, I keep coming back to Warhammer 40K because, you know, Dune is based on Foundation and Warhammer is just Dune with the serial numbers filed off and everything turned up to 11.
Okay.
But like in the Warhammer, they keep everything is tracked based on the solar year because, you know, Holy Terra is where humans came from. And everyone still kind of reveres the burnt out husk of Earth, even 40,000 years later. So and there's a whole bunch of complex like timekeeping to make adjustments for, you know, warp travel and all that. And
I get fucked up with daylight savings, like, man. I would hate to see if I lived on another planet with a different day night cycle. Wow.
Oh, no, there's whole grim dark portions of the story where like wars fought over time differences and stuff. So I keep on, but like, you know, this feels like, so like, you're right. We don't know if this is like how far in the future they are. We only know it's at least 12 millennia into the future,
right? Based like, on their calendar system, which we don't fully understand what that would be. Yeah,
that's true. That's, you're right. We don't even know that those years actually, you know, fully. You're right. So yeah, it's just a big. But that's the thing. It's like, and also it's important to realize that this isn't the Kleon dynasty. That's just the latest. That's just been the latest this tweak to stability they made to this empire that has stretched back millennia of some kind of time. So it's just like, this is just a vast amount of time more than, you know, oh, this is exactly 12,000 years in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to say it's like 10,000 because of what you said. Like maybe, you know, a human civilization would hang on to some, you know, soul-based, SOL-based calendar.
Yeah.
So maybe we are like 10,000 years into the future from our current existence. Yeah.
And also, like, in 12,000 years, how could you ever say that you never lost a few years here and there? You know, like, that would be like us talking. I mean, 12,000 years is a long fucking time. Like, that's pre-human history.
It's a lot of
we haven't
years.
Had that many years to account for. And there's been so many calendars, you know, like if you read some kind of like Egyptian chronology, you would have to have a whole bunch of things that you would have to put together to even make sense of what that date was. So I could easily like it might, you know, like in terms of absolute time, it's kind of like we're in the year 2021. But what the fuck does that mean outside of a very narrow human reference, you know?
Yeah.
But that's what's so cool about the whole Empire spanning a whole galaxy lasting this time is like there's so much. This is almost like Tolkien mythology. We're talking second and third ages and, you know, prehistory and pre-creation myths. Like who the fuck knows?
And I just love this stuff because like it's very easy to get really myopic on these concepts like a calendar. I mean, it's such a simple concept, right? We keep track of the days and nights and seasons and years, and that's pretty much it. But that concept is an artificial construct of humanity, and it's very myopic. It's very relative to our experience of the universe. And what would change about that? I'd love to think about those things.
Oh yeah, like how, like, you know, when you think about like shows like The Expanse, like would the day and the year survive the colonization of the solar system, let alone the galaxy? My right? God. So it is interesting.
All right, we go to Terminus, where the Anacreons cloak their flak cannon to hide it from someone other than the Foundation. I assumed the Empire. That just made sense. Then they all start shooting at the fence around the settlement while Salvor's dad hands out weapons to the scientists. Eventually they stop, and Salvor tries to talk some sense into one of Farr's men. He's not interested, though. And then the Imperial ship jumps in.
Yeah, I thought this was pretty clever that, like, you know, we got this giant, you know, we thought it was going to be a siege weapon to blow up the city, and then it gets cloaked. And like Hugo says, like, what the fuck? We, you know, it's only cloaks an area of like exactly the size of the giant planetary cannon. So like what the hell?
I was super confused about this. I thought there was a huge continuity error where they cloaked the cannon and then in the next shot just didn't cloak it. And because I kept seeing it in the background, I'm like, They couldn't have forgotten something this big. And then I realized this is a cloaking canopy. This is like
right.
a cloak that only kind of, you know, if you think of an awning off the top of your house, right? They put a flak cannon under that. That's
yeah,
what
like
this
those
is.
Camouflage nets they used to throw on jets and stuff. Uh-huh. Like it doesn't, you can, when you're on the ground, it's like, that's a fucking jet with a tint on it or right. something. But when right. from the air, it just looks like a jungle canopy or whatever. Yeah, so yeah, I think you're right. And also, there's some scenes from clearly within the cloak field, too. But I shared your confusion on the first time, too. I was like, huh, I wonder if they're... Yeah, surely they're not losing track of that stuff.
It's too big. I was kind of curious about Salvor's estimation of the Anacreons here, because she says, like, they're desperate and they're scared, and scared people make mistakes. I don't know if I agree that they are scared. I agree that they're desperate. They do not seem scared. They seem resolved.
I think there'll be some fear there, though, I suppose. But I it's weird because like I felt like Salvor was just kind of like seeing what would stick here, because even when she was saying it, the guy didn't seem like he bought it.
No,
you know,
not at all.
And there's also like, you know, this plan required a lot of things to go right that did. And I imagine there might be some nervousness and fear that if they get it wrong, then they're all dead.
Mm-hmm. If she can't bring down the shield.
Why do you think the Anacreons are firing at the fence?
I have no idea. Intimidation
to rattle them. But like these scientists were already like cowed the moment they showed up. Like there's a scene of, you know, Lester from The Wire, Salvor's father, you know, trying to push a rifle in the scientist's hand. She's like, I'm just a scientist. They go, you'll be a dead scientist if you don't pick up this fucking rifle and shoot the. Yeah. I mean, these guys were, even the wardens were like, had their shit and pants on.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, about the only one that wasn't scared was like Hugo, Salvor, and Salvor's dad.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I think if it was an intimidation tactic, it was working. But then we move on to the Imperial scanning the planet. They spot the Anacreons. They get in contact with Terminus. Salvor tells the Imperials that they should stay clear, but they want to get eyes on Farah and give Terminus 10 minutes to move her to the tower, which I guess is going to give them. Yeah, I'm not totally clear. There's some leaps of sanity here with what this plan is, but who knows? I don't understand their tech and all that stuff, so maybe it makes sense.
Salvor's, I don't think they have teleporters, though, so they would have to, like, if he wanted to lay eyes on her, he'd have to send the shuttle down and or send her back up, and I guess the tower is kind of the spaceport or the city center, so...
I suppose. Docking procedures or anything like that, so...
Right. Or maybe this place is so rustic that he wouldn't, like, meet anything else, maybe. I'm not exactly... Like I said, I do think there is a little bit of fast and loose being played with some stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. Salvor's comms are jammed by the Anacreons, just locally where she stands out by the fence. Salvor realizes the Anacreons want Farah in the tower, and why? Because the field arrays are in the tower and she's going to destroy them. And so she rushes back to town.
And I thought they showed the Anacreons being smart of like cutting communications at certain times, like let just enough information to flow to get to their ends. But then, you know, it's like, okay, the Imperial demanded to meet the person and take him here as per Imperial protocol. Probably that's what it is, Imperial protocol. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they start a little back and forth where, you know, they might talk themselves out or like share information like, oh, by the way, they have a flat cannon that might pose a danger to your ship. They cut it off there. It does make you wonder when, you know, when the guy asks for a status report, why does she say, like, hey, they have this big ass cannon right outside our wall. Might want to keep a distance.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel you. It's maybe like an oversight by her, but I don't even think she fully understands that she's going to be in control of this conversation until the conversation is happening, right?
Yeah. Like, I think they did a good job. She is not a military person.
No.
She's resourceful and she's strong, but she's like a ranger or a warden. She's like Aragorn at the beginning of Lord of the Rings. She's not.
And she's never had to face kind of threat of aside from Bishop's claws, right? Some wild animals. So
that she has completely like cowed at this point. Like, you know, she's pulling arrows out of them and taming them as pets and sending them scattering just with a shot into the ceiling, you know? So like, you're right. She's, and which is why the whole colony's kind of gotten soft, why she keeps getting denied for her, you know, requests for weapons and requests for drilling. And, you know, clearly there's only like two or three people in this whole fucking settlement that are comfortable holding a gun and know what to do with it. So yeah, I think you're right. Like, she's not ready to give a sit rep, you know?
For sure. So then we go back to Gale. She can't input any commands because she's not authorized. So instead, she begins searching the data banks here. She finds the Terminus is already set up. Lewis has taken over as commander after Harry's death, and that Rache was the murderer of Harry. And then she gets another recording of Lewis questioning Rache, who says he did what he had to do. And then finally she gets Rache's execution video and it gets real sad, real sad.
Damn, why would you ever do this? Why would you ever want to see the execution video of your loved one unless you want to burn it into your mind in like some kind of like revenge kind of way? And I wonder if they're setting up like Gale to be a different version of Farah, like, you know, extremely motivated by her personal grief and anger that she feels. Because like, I'm like, yeah, if I heard that Cecily got ran over by a bus and there was high def surveillance footage of it, you know, my wife getting dismembered by a 60-mile, I would be like, I don't need to watch that. I really don't. She's executed by some criminal and I wanted to become like fucking Frank Castle and become the Punisher and hunt them down and throw away my whole life on a vengeance. okay, then sure, yeah, I want all that pain, inject it right into my veins. It seems like, well, of course, she's also young and stupid, so maybe she hasn't realized how scarred up she's making herself. But I feel like it is. Do you feel me on this? Like, this feels like a person about ready to undertake a mission with a capital M.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a bit of a stretch by the episode to get where they need to get. And there are a couple of things in this scene that feel like that. And I don't have any foreknowledge of this. I don't. None of this is in the books. Right. Exactly. But there's a line in this scene that tells me. It says something, and I want to talk with you about it. A casket he himself designed. When speaking about Harry Seldon's coffin, they specifically mentioned that he designed it, which to me says there's something more here. Why include that detail? Why watch the execution video, right? It's because they're getting to somewhere they need to get to with this character.
Yeah, and I also thought it was a real giveaway when they said the coffin he himself designed. They did a close up on Harry Seldon's face. You saw just embarrassed of a smug smirk. No, that didn't
That's
happen.
Just his
but
face.
Like, no, but I as soon as I heard that, I'm like, there's like flashing red arrows with like the Harry's. I mean,
right?
Yeah,
and
he
so
specially
I rewound
designed
it.
Did he?
I was looking at the coffin. I'm like, okay, what features could this coffin have that could possibly be important? The one thing I came up with is that this is shaped roughly, and I know most coffins are, but this is shaped roughly like the vault itself.
I noticed the same thing.
And I don't know if that's going to be important. And also there are other things about stuff that happens later in this episode, like her destination. We'll find out is Harry Seldon's home planet.
Yeah.
Which is did he send himself in some kind of like destruction and rebirth style resurrection coffin that's going to send him to his home planet, and he's going to be like waiting there for her?
Dude, this is like, Foundation 3, The Search for Seldon. Like,
did he
soft launch himself into the Genesis planet, and now he's like coming back via. Especially in conjunction with the final scene. I mean, this is a mind blowing thing for a person like you and me. They're book readers that like, is Harry alive?
And it's all delivered in a single like 6-word line, right? That's sure. That seems like a non issue.
And the most boring milquetoast person in the galaxy delivering it, Lewis. You know?
Right. And there's also other stuff they're doing in this scene where, you know, clearly Raish is delivering a message to Gale
and saying, don't lose Gale. Don't I know you're 34 years in the future. You're going to watch this for some inexplicable reason.
Right.
Don't lose faith in the plan. And you can, you know, quoting what she said to him in the second episode, that you can still solve a puzzle if, a piece or two are missing.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, he completely chokes on the either I love you or Han Solo. I know. He just stutters I before he gets blown out the old space gate. What do they call that? The airlock.
The space gate.
he got the belter, traditional belter execution from the Expanse.
And I think the line I understand more than you when he's talking to Lewis is definitely a hint here that this is all part of the plan between him and Harry.
I understand what I've done, chump. Yeah.
All right, let's take another quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
All right, so Salvor is too late to stop Farrah from being removed, or not removed, moved to the tower. So she runs toward the tower where Farrah is digging out her eye, which turns out to be an EMP device, and destroys the field relays and takes all the fences offline.
Pretty metal.
I love
like,
it.
I wondered if, I was actually thinking, like, I wonder if Farrah's going to explode like a bomb.
Yeah.
Same you know, kind of like what we saw in the first thing, because like then that would make perfect sense why Salvor saw that this is the end for her, but it was only the first stage of her plan.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of sort of bummed out that that's not what happened.
The eye thing was cool, though. Like they pointed it out that it's a fake eye, right? Earlier.
Yeah.
And we
yeah,
just thought it was part of the scars that she's got.
Her injuries.
Right?
Sure. Yeah. And it probably was like it's probably like, yeah, you know, yeah, related, you know. And there's something poetic to that, that you use the damage the enemy gave you to hurt them, to wound them.
Yeah, turning a weakness into a strength.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, as they pointed out in the official podcast, you can't get much more biblical in terms of justice than the concept of an eye for an eye.
A literal
so
eye.
So I thought yeah, that was pretty slick, too.
It is. I liked it. Now, I will say the first time I watched this, I thought, oh, that's a bomb and Lewis is dead. And Farrah's mm-hmm, dead, and everybody who is standing in the vicinity is dead. Second time through, later when none of those people were actually dead, I was like, okay, oh right, EMP device.
Yeah, they called it a disruptor, which I assume is just okay, essentially a 17th century, or no, I'm sorry,
120th.
Yeah, how do you say
121st century?
It's the 22nd millennium? No, it's more than that, isn't it?
No, it'd be
yeah,
the
we're in
12th,
we're
13th
in the
millennium?
Third millennium. So yeah, it would be like the 12th millennium. Yeah, it's some kind of 12th millennium crazy EMP device.
Yeah.
Because yeah, you can't fit an EMP in something the size of a Weeble Wobble.
No, I've seen Ocean's 11. It's,
yeah,
it's big.
Yeah,
it's a van size
It barely
thing,
fits in a work van. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then Gale gets a scalpel, intending to kill herself, but she's suddenly thrown to the ground by a gravity shift in the shower, which looks very cool. I have some questions, but we'll get there in a sec.
She goes
to the control room, finds out they're approaching their destination, but the computer won't tell her where she's headed. So she uses her knowledge of the galaxy and mathematics to figure out what their destination appears to be, which is actually nowhere, because it turns out the computer is censoring the view screen. Because she's not authorized to view it. So she decides to put on a space suit to go get a real view of the situation.
Yeah, I mean, so the problem I have with this is like this ship did the most violent flip and burn, and she must be at the literal center of the ship's axis for this to actually
right,
play. And like, okay. Because damn. And also, what? Yeah, like what if the ship had just killed her? It seems like there is a lot of things being taken for chance in the Seldon plan here, which is a little bit worrisome. But
yeah, and the show is also playing very fast and loose with these concepts, right? I mean, this is a civilization, as I mentioned before, that has a supreme grasp on gravity. It can control it. And you see an example of it in this episode where the knife is pulled from her hand, right? And maybe that's magnetism, and
right,
it just pulls it over there. But like things like the pool that I mentioned,
the pool, they specifically put that in to show that the gravity is artificial. It's not like propulsion based.
Yeah, it's not perpendicular to the plane of thrust. So like,
exactly.
The Expanse uses this stuff and makes interesting scenarios that are also beautiful, right? They have beautiful choreography, and it uses the gravity as like a central focal point to put all that around. This show is playing a lot faster and looser with what gravity is going to do in any scene based on the rule of cool, I think.
100%. And it, but it is beautiful. I will say the scene of the slow motion, her flip and turn and in this sonic shower or whatever the hell it is, a suicide shower. It did look amazing, even though I don't think it made literal sense.
No. And I think people, I understand if people want to get hung up on this because this is a pretty hard sci-fi series. And, you know, I appreciate when The Expanse sweats those details. But
yeah, and this show does a fair amount of sweating the details as well. But like, it does seem like it's a curious blend of this high science fiction and like almost science fantasy. But also, they are 12 millennia ahead of us. So,
right.
You know, some of this is going to seem magical. You can kind of wave away with the Clark. Yeah, is this advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But in this case, it seems like, yeah, like they're.
And I want to give them some props because they do talk in the official podcast about how hard it was to conceptualize and then write and film the scene where she is planning or trying to figure out where she is in relation to the other stars and everything and where they might be headed, because they consulted with mathematicians and physicists and people who actually know how to calculate these things. And had them sort of give their input on all of this. And then, you know, tried to artistically turn that into something that the audience could intuitively understand without actually understanding anything she's saying, because I don't.
Yeah, I thought their point was right on, that they're trying to create something like when you watch ER, you don't know what the fuck the doctor, when they're saying, you know, 50 cc's no. of blah, blah, blah stat and give me this. And you don't know what they mean, but what you get is that they are very competent in what they're doing. And
yeah,
I know enough of geometry and trigonometry and to kind of get the gist of what they're doing. She's using like parallax, like redshift to determine like the direction she's moving. And she's using known positions of like quasars and things. I think when, because like, she's like, yeah, are we speeding up or slowing down? I forget, and the computer wouldn't tell her, so she's like, well, just call me up the expected, I forget exactly, the spectrographs from this star, and then compared them, how blue or red they were based on that to see.
Gotcha.
So, like,
okay, that's
like
cool.
I said, it's like, I like, you know, this kind of astronomy, space-time kind of stuff. If you read Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time.
Yeah.
Jesus, I sound insufferable. What I'm saying is, like, I didn't get all of this, but I got enough to, like, if you probably went and poked around, you could, you know, an astrophysicist could probably do the same thing she did. And it works thematically because, you know, like her creator said, from destruction comes rebirth. She's personally been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And it also tracks with the black hole. If you get spaghettified through a black hole, then your atoms will exist from your perspective for almost forever. But black holes evaporate very slowly. She mentions like you're always like shrinking, but you're never quite gone.
Mm-hmm.
In this state that she's still got something, a kernel left, and that's her knowledge. You know, she's personally destroyed. She has nothing. She's had everything taken from her.
Yeah.
And apparently even her agency, because the computer won't let her do shit except access her information and her nimble mind to assemble it. So I thought that stuff worked really well.
Yeah, I thought so too. The Anacreons attack Terminus, and Lewis apparently, you know, survives EMP attack, as did Farah, who has now taken Salvor's mother hostage. The Imperials begin to land as the flak cannon tracks them. Salvor manages to get her mother out of Farah's hands and they fight. Salvor wins, but unfortunately there are more Anacreons there who take her mother hostage again. This whole scene feels like destruction and rebirth, because they end up in the exact same position they were in before.
This is the other like a problem I had with the episode. A couple of, I guess, in here. When their shields fall, they did a very good job of showing us the strength, the disposition, and the position of all the various troops. And they showed, like, the masses of the Anacreons charging, guns blazing. The fact that they didn't hit anyone, apparently, I really was thinking halfway through the scene, it's like, oh, this must be another stage of the ruse. They're not trying to kill, especially when they cut back and, like, you know, you find out that she's actually trying to find the manifest. You know, it's like, oh, they must... they must not want to kill anybody. They just want to scare him and hurt him in a direction. Because, like, holy fucking Imperial Stormtroopers, Batman. These people can't hit the fucking broadside of the barn.
Yeah.
But then the very next scene, it's a wholesale scene of slaughter. Mm-hmm. So I felt like either put the wardens behind cover, because it's honestly, you know, they're telling the story of these people don't know what the fuck they're doing. They're just standing out in the open with a gun held at their waist level, like cringing. And that's fine, but they should have all died.
Yeah.
Like maybe Salver's dad is savvy enough to like get the cover. But I felt like, I don't know. It's like, it's felt like an unforced error to have all these people exposed. And then you show these people shooting and firing, but no one dies. But then there's just absolute carnage in the next scene. So it's like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It felt weird. Like, you know, the incompetence apparently of the Anacreon charge, and then how ruthlessly efficient they were at killing their way towards the tower.
Yeah, I agree. Some of the execution on this is not perfect, and that was one of the examples, certainly.
What I'm still confused, because Ferris' stated goal is help commandeering an Imperial starship.
Uh-huh.
Some sub goal of that is getting the manifest of the Deliverance.
Is it the I thought it was a navigation module. Is that?
Well, that's what she said in the beginning, but her mom said she wants the crew manifest from the Deliverance, which is the slow ship that took him here.
Okay.
So like and clearly here's an Imperial starship. She did not commandeer it. She fucking destroyed it.
Yeah.
I thought when it first got winged in the, you know, the extreme lower position, it was going to crash land, but still be, you know, because it's an Imperial starship, it's mm-hmm. probably tough. It'll still be something they can salvage. No, it blew the fuck up. This is like dunzo. So I don't know what to make. I don't know what to make of that. There's clearly something more to come, and they need Salvor alive to guarantee success at getting it, is the thing that I got too.
Yeah, the manifest is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Is there somebody on there, like in their colony, that would be important, potentially not on there?
Yeah, like, is Harry, like, did they know? Because, you know, clearly they're pissed off about Seldon, his prophecies, quote unquote, you know, putting the galaxy on a boil and getting their planet blown up.
Yeah.
But surely they wouldn't be like suspicious that he would survive and gotten off, or are they looking for Gale Dor? I don't know. I mean, clearly this is a mystery that you're supposed to wonder about, and it's going to, you know, it's going to pay off in the episodes to come. But you got any ideas on that?
No, I really don't. I do want to talk about that big leap in logic where she sort of blames, you know, Salvor and Harry for the destruction of her planet, but we'll get there in another scene or two.
I thought it was pretty funny, the mom stuff where she's like, fucking, you know, like she's almost like Rick Sanchez, like, fuck it, kill, you know, take out your hostage. Let's restart. Yeah, I never felt that mother daughter bond. And
she's totally right. Like, kill your cover, kill your bargaining chip, and then we'll start from even here with my gun trained on you. Right. Like,
exactly.
What the fuck are you going to do?
Yeah. But like, it's also cuts a little close enough to how Salver kind of feels about her family. I think that like her mom's like, you told me to drop, right? Oh, yeah, mom. That's all you meant? She didn't say, like, oh, look, mom, I love you and everything's good. She's like, hey, you just did good, ma.
Yeah.
And ran off. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, for sure. We go back to Gale, who is on a spacewalk. Still can't see where she is going, so she applies an infrared filter and realizes they're headed to a dark star. This scene will give me nightmares. When she is, you know, back pressed against the ship, and then she jumps away from it, I'm like, you're dead. Mm-hmm. You're done. Gone. See you later. And then I realized she was clipped. Tethered to the ship. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, thank goodness.
But
that's
even
terrifying.
Then,
yes.
I think I've had a nightmare of me doing a spacewalk and doing something like that, and the fucking carabiner just breaks, or the mm-hmm. you know, I'm too big a boy, and the strap snaps or right. something. Like, that
or the
is...
ship flips again. Did you see how violently that ship must have flipped?
That thing, it's this, you know, space is terrifying. Like, you know, I've been watching season one of The Expanse to kind of get ready for the new season, and my son's not seen it, so we're having fun, good time watching through. But like, you know, season one where his uncle spaces Diogo. And he's just spinning in the utter blackness of the belt. And it's just terrifying. Like, I felt like it was really reminded me of like Neo trying to step outside his office building where she's like, you know, like even though she knows she's attached to a ship, she's just really, it's one of the, it reminded me the first time I rappelled. Like,
yeah,
I was just shitting my pants until I finally completely trusted the harness and like, oh, this is so bad. But like, you know, like, and I thought that was really, really well done how they show how like naturally terrifying this must be, especially for someone like Gale, who comes from this backwards planet that doesn't truck with technology and has kind of turned her back on that. They don't have a spaceport that's like heavily trafficked and all that. Never been in space before. Yeah. It felt cool.
It serves, you know, I don't know if they intend this, but it definitely serves a indicator of how far she's come in her, you know, quest for knowledge, right? Like, because the thing you said about trusting that the mechanism you're putting your life in the hands of is actually going to work, it takes a few tries. It takes a firm belief that this is a sound system, right? In order to fully trust that and get comfortable there. And I feel like she's gotten there because she trusts the science. You know, she trusts her suit, she trusts the tether, she trusts all that stuff. So we go back to Terminus, where the Imperial ship approaches and demands that everyone stand down. Farrah gets a black eye, and then she makes Salvor watch the destruction of Terminus, blaming Seldon for destroying her homeworld by predicting the destruction of the Empire. Hugo's injured in the fighting. The Anacreons shoot down the Imperial ship, and Farrah knocks out Salvor. This is a pretty big leap in logic, I think. To say that,
did you?
Harry,
I thought it made sense.
It makes sense if you believe in psychohistory, I guess, and if you understand that this is part of Harry's plan.
Well, I don't think it requires that. Even if you think this is nuts, like I don't believe in QAnon, but I do believe it almost tore our country apart, and still may well. Like, you know, like if psychohistory is completely wrong, but enough people believe it and get people amped up and agitated, and it just, you know, makes people do something crazy, then even though believe in it.
She thinks that he inspired some terrorists to go in there and blow up the Starbridge, which, you know, the Empire blamed on
I mean,
their...
any prophet of doom.
Okay.
Like, that makes more sense. Like, I think, and then there's an open question about, did Harry try to engineer the fall because he wants to engender something better? Like, you know, humanity is being held back by an empire. He wants to, I don't know, have a galaxy-wide democracy or something reform.
Or for his legacy. Like, I mean,
that's the thing, like, right, that's the thing. This is all about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And before Rome was an empire, it was a republic. It was a lot more, you know, democratic. Never democratic as we were today, but, like, you know, not for nothing. They had a Senate and people were elected and they served terms and whatnot. And I, you know, like it could be that Harry, you know, has enough student of history to know that there was more democratic things. And that's kind of what you need for stability. Like, you know, we didn't choose democracy necessarily because everyone sat at a whiteboard and like, oh, this is the best way to do it. It's just like, you know, it is a way for humans continued to urbanize. And you know, technology continued to increase, and our population increased. It was the most stable form of government. So, like, I wonder if he engineered this fall, like, and it was worth it to him to get 1,000 years of darkness out of the way, and then get humanity back on a bright and shining path. Than it was, you know, to just continue to just fuck around for another 10,000 years, the empire crumble anywhere away, and it takes, you know, 10,000 years to get back. I don't know. That could be something. It could be literally his fault, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, there are many ways you can read his intentions, and the effects of that, the chaos theory.
We didn't talk much about the fight between Salvor and Farrah. And I don't know, like, it's like she's the grand huntress. So I figure she's like a mighty warrior. And I'm like, and when I first watched this, I'm like, I don't really buy that Harden's hanging with her. But then the second time I realized/observed that her hands were cuffed. So she's like literally fighting with both hands tied in front of her body.
Yeah.
So like, okay, well, maybe, you know, Harden, who's no slouch for when it comes to personal defense and combat and probably training, did a lot of simulating, blah, blah, blah. maybe she could, with a, you know, great hunter with no weapons and her hands bound, could, you know, beat her to a stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
Also, fuck that sundial. Should have gone water clock. I like that. The show itself knew they got it wrong on the sundial. Yeah. They had to conspicuously show it getting broken, getting destroyed.
Pretty good. It's useful for something, though. Stabbing your enemies.
That's true.
All right. Final scene here. Gail returns from her spacewalk, knowing her destination, and commands the computer to change course because she also knows that it's Harry's homeworld. And that's not a place she wants to be if everybody thinks she murdered him. It doesn't comply. Instead, it reenacts Harry's death for her.
Yeah, well, does it? Or is this something that... I don't know what we're seeing here. It's a really weird glitched out version of him dying. Like, are we seeing like some kind of rebirth of a AI bootstrapped Selden consciousness? Like what the fuck?
I guess. Yeah. The big question here is if this was supposed to be Raish on this ship, what is the purpose of showing Raish this murder? Was Raish not supposed to be the one who murdered him? Was he? Was it supposed to be someone else and Raish was supposed to be the Gale in this situation or what?
I don't know. Because like plan obviously included 35 years of cryo sleep, and regardless of who or what, like that's the thing I keep coming back. Like this was all part of the plan, whether it happened with Raish or Gale, and that the fact the plan must be capable of being saved even if you make a dramatic personnel change at the last minute. And not only that, but the computer that's running the fucking thing gets the identification of who it's holding wrong.
Yeah.
I'm really rooting for them to connect all these dots together because I like what they're building. But man, there's a lot of questions. Of course, we're right here in the middle of the season. You should have a bunch of questions.
For sure. Yeah. I do think what I'm kind of expecting of this is that there will have been some message coming from Harry to his homeworld here. So that when she arrives, she's not going to be greeted as a traitorous murderer, but she will be greeted in some other fashion. I don't know if it'll be like a heroic fashion or if she'll be like their new leader and the one to like take over some other plan he had on another planet. But like there's going to be some twist here. I don't think she's going to be a villain when she gets there.
Oh, for sure. Well, I don't know. But if she is, I'm convinced she can talk herself out of it. I don't know. I'm like I said, I can't wait to find out where this goes.
OK, that's the end of the episode.
Yeah. So here's the part where we've gone a long time here and we're still got to probably another 15-20 conversation ahead of us. We're going to split the feedback off starting this week. If you're listening to this on the first day on Monday when it releases, then the feedback episode will probably be out Tuesday, maybe Wednesday. And then going forward again, this Friday's episode, when it drops, we'll have our episode out, same date, and then next Tuesday, we'll have the feedback episode. And you can send feedback in to foundation@baldmove.com. If you have a question for David S. Goyer, make sure you throw in the word Goyer somewhere in the subject line so I can easily find it. It's G-O-Y-E-R, because I'm going to do a special harvest of like questions and stuff Friday morning. And you want to make sure you get that to me before Friday morning so you don't miss the cutoff. And I don't know, maybe we'll get to talk to him more than once. Maybe we'll get to do a season wrap up with him. I'm certainly going to try to angle for that, but, we'll see how it goes. But this is for sure an opportunity to get your questions answered. And I'd like to pass that on. So foundation@baldmove.com, get your feedback and, we will see you this Friday. But before you go, if you are up on the books or you kind of are, and you know, don't really care about spoilers, especially since we're talking about this being a very different series, Jim and I are going to talk about a couple topics that have come up this week based on our, again, informed book speculation and questions about pacing and stuff. So I think I've stalled enough time to give the people that don't want to hear spoilers, please turn off the podcast now. There's nothing but potential book spoilers awaiting you here. All right, let's talk about it. First topic, pacing. What are we talking about here? The difference between the book and the show in terms of pacing.
So there are, what, 7 books in the Foundation series? There are the 3 originals, 2 prequels, and 2 sequels. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
They're either 7 or 8. And there are supposed to be 8 seasons of this show, right? So the timeline seemed to line up pretty nicely with the number of books covering 1 book per season. After watching the first half of the first season, I'm going to say that there is absolutely no way they get through the rest of book 1 in this season. Because yes. In the first book, we are not even a third of the way through that book.
I agreed.
There are 3 big changes in the foundation for the first book. They start off as this sort of like, you know, the setup of it, right? The what is Terminus? What is the foundation? And then they evolve from, you know, this fledgling settlement society to a religion. And then they evolve past the religion with the whole Anacreon Thespis stuff to a merchant society. So those are huge changes, not just on like a, you know, oh, well, they got to do all this stuff. No, they have to change everything about Terminus. And the stories they've been telling have been so small in scope comparatively. I just don't think there's any way we get even halfway through the first book in this first season.
Yeah, and I don't know that that bothers me, because clearly, you know, like all the stuff that they brought in about Raish thus far, I understand has came from one of the prequels. So I think, you know, are they a third of the way through the 7 book series? You
right.
Know, at this halfway point in the first, that seems like a less scary way to be like, oh, okay, well, that's not bad. So like if they bring in, this isn't like Game of Thrones where everything is just like, you got Game of Thrones and then you got the Storm of Swords and then you got the Clash of Kings and then you got, so, you know, like this is. Even the in order of publication, this stuff wasn't like in chronological order. So if they go back and interleave all that stuff, I think there's plenty of material. And then they're also just expanding on stuff like this there Klingon stuff didn't exist. I don't know if the sequels or prequels flesh out the Gale stuff, but I think there's I think that people seem to get antsy about you know, the 15 minutes of like, oh, this is just repeated information. If they go back and like, you know, let's say we get a 20 minute vignette of Salver Hardin's childhood, you know, and like, what if they reenact the scene of her mom crawling to get her underneath the, like, I could see them doing that and I could see it pissing off a lot of people. And they're again saying that like, we're just retreading information we already know. And I do think that there is a lot. I side with you when you said, well, yeah, we knew it intellectually, but we didn't know what it was like emotionally. And that's important to their character.
Yeah,
I think that. But like if it feels like the show is deliberately slowing down the pace, I could see people losing their patience with it. I'm not saying it's happened so far, but
I mean, it could be a case where we get through the plot of the first 3. You know, as written the first 3 Foundation novels. But we've pulled in so many pieces, so many elements of what makes the prequels and the sequels what they are, that you won't really miss any of that stuff because right. It will kind of be contained. It won't, conceptually and thematically, it'll be contained within the what we get in the series. I don't know. I don't really know what the plan is. Maybe, you know, when we talk with Goyer, he could perhaps eliminate that some, though he has on the official podcast a bit too.
I will say that his, they confirmed, I think a week or two ago, Apple said that they have renewed Foundation for season 2.
Yeah.
So regardless of, you know, whether, you know, the regardless how many people are watching this season, what the critics say, we are going to get guaranteed a second season. And usually, you know, almost every show I watch, you know, you learn a lot about making the show the first season and things kind of get kind of smooth and gel more and the plot lines start to come together. So I'm glad. I was really worried that like it might be one and done because, you know, who knows what Apple's metrics are, and some prominent TV critics are kind of, you know, not panned it, but said it's kind of like, eh. So I'm glad we're going to get at least 2 seasons of this thing. So we'll see. We'll see how the pacing goes out. Related to this, I've read the first, the initial 3 book trilogy, and the curveball they throw Psychohistory in, I think the third book, and they've already name checked it in the very beginning of the episode, and she's listing off names of people, and she mentions the mule. So the mule is in the first psychic with precognition in the Foundation galaxy. And because it was an unknown type of person who can see into the future and thus affect it, there's like this big shadow cast over Psychohistory of like uncertainty and doubt. And a lot of the third book is revolving. Does Harry have a plan for the unplannable? Is there a way that you can get the predictions on track? Is there a variable that you like, the relativity, you had the special relativity and then you had the general that kind of explained everything. Is there some kind of, that form of Psychohistory where you put a new variable for precogs and you can still kind of like get back the history going and accounted for? It's wild that they are bringing that stuff like right away. Like it seems obvious to me that they're hinting with Gale, especially, the fact she has bad feelings and she has like, premonitions and stuff and like
waking Salver, up like, during the transport. Yeah.
100%. And Salver, she already is doing these like crazy things with the coin flipping and the fact that she can kind of divine what was going on at Farrah's mind and her history and all that stuff. Seems like they're tackling that stuff front and center, which is such a huge change. Like, I wonder like what other kind of like butterfly flaps are going to, instead of that being like the last reveal or the last kind of challenge that it's kind of woven into the story at the beginning. That's the thing that I find the most fascinating about the pacing. Like
Gotcha.
That's pretty, pretty wild.
That's big. I haven't read that third book, but I am super fascinated by the concept of a predictive engine, essentially, through Psychohistory that then runs sort of smack face into borderline magical,
like human evolution
a borderline magical power to predict the future and see the future. Sure. And the potential. So maybe what Harry Seldon is getting up to here, if I can do a little theory crafting by bringing Gale in and talking about her being special, is if she is the mule, she is that character with precognition. Mm. If he can convert her to his quote unquote religion here of Psychohistory.
Right.
Add her and use her as a tool to further his plan. That might be all he needs to do. Right. If he can co-opt the unpredictable element into the plan and set it on course for the plan itself, maybe that is enough.
And see, this makes a lot of sense with her talk about like looking at Psychohistory. It seems like there's a couple pieces missing. She could be the piece, her and Salver, this new race of, psychic potential humans could be that missing piece that like Harry's already kind of accounted for. And that's why he selected her. That's why.
Right.
It's all super interesting. It's just so it's such a remix. Like they're really playing jazz with the material, which, again, I appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I've definitely liked adaptations that have been right down the middle, like the first few episodes or first few seasons of Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, broadly speaking. I also like it when, like, The Leftovers, one of my favorite series, very loosely, the first season based on the first book, the entirety of the first book. I don't know if you know this, two more seasons of Leftovers. So, like, that's a perfect example of something that kind of really plays jazz. So,
but in Game of Thrones...
Walking Dead is the worst case of scenario where they kind pretty much do the former, except for they just change things just to, amuse the comic book readers, I guess. So it remains to be seen where they're going with Foundation.
I think in stuff like Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, stuff where you have adaptations of works, they're already very rich. I don't think anybody would call Foundation exciting or a rich experience. I think they would call it extraordinarily dry, but intellectually titillating, right? That's what Foundation is to me, but like that
like
doesn't
Gale
quite work on television.
Mathematics scrolls.
Right. I don't want that show on television, right? The adaptation of a show like this is so difficult because far more difficult than those other shows because none of that is in there. They've got to make it all up.
That book is not cinematic at all.
No. And so to convert it to something you have to watch is a monumental task, and it's going to require this kind of mix-up stuff. So I'm taking the series for what it is. I will be excited if they get through one book or three books or all the books by the end of this series, whatever. I just want a compelling story that in which the themes of the Foundation novels resonate. Right.
Mm-hmm. And then the final point, this came out of David Goyer's podcast, the official one. Jason Concepcion asked him, what is in the vault? Or what is the nature of the vault? And I thought Goyer is going to say, go fuck yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the Library of Babel, which is a literary allusion. And I'm like, hot damn. So I don't know about you. I went to Wikipedia, typed in Library of Babel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they say. The Library of Babel is a short story by Argentine author and librarian Jorge Luis Borges, conceiving of a universe in the form of a vast library containing all possible 410-page books of a certain format and character set. Borges' narrator describes how his universe consists of an enormous expanse of adjacent hexagonal rooms. Hexagonal. In each room, there's an entrance on one wall, the bare necessities for human survival.
Hexagonal, if you want to say it correctly.
Thank you. Yes, I don't really care to, but it's nice to get on the record. And then you have the bare necessity of a human survival on the other wall, and then you have four walls of bookshelves. Through the order and content of the books are random and apparently completely meaningless, the inhabitants of this world believe the books contain every possible ordering of just 25 basic characters. And in this language, you got 22 letters, period, comma, and space. Though the vast majority of the books in the universe are pure gibberish, the library must also contain, somewhere, every coherent book that's ever been written or might ever be written, and every possible pure permutation or slightly erroneous version of every one of those books.
The narrator at least notes in that format, right? With that alphabet, with that character set in that length. Yeah.
Right. The narrator notes that the library must contain all useful information, including predictions of the future, biographies of any person, translations of every book in all languages. Conversely, for many of the texts, some languages could be devised that would make it readable with any of a vast number of different contents. Despite or indeed because of this glut of information, all books are totally useless to the reader, leaving the librarians in a state of suicidal despair. This leads some librarians to superstitious and cult-like behaviors. Eh? Such as the purifiers who arbitrarily destroy books that they deem as nonsense as they scour through the library seeking the Crimson Hexagon and its illustrated magical books. Others believe that since all books exist in libraries somewhere, one of the books must be a perfect index of the library's contents. Some even believe that's a messianic figure known only as the man of the book has read it and as they travel through this library seeking him. Now, I've read Foundation. I think I got a pretty good handle of what the vault is. And this is super fucking cool. Really cool sci-fi concept on the order of psychohistory by itself. But it's not the vault that I know of in the book. The vault is also not a coffin containing the body of Harry Seldon. What do you make of this, man?
So is what's in the vault a data set of all possible outcomes that when combined with the Prime Radiant is somehow the key to psychohistory and interpreting
the Prime Radiant, the Crimson Hexagon? Because psychohistory could, with the right variables, probably run forward and backwards and predict anything.
God, this book sounds fucking fascinating. I have to read Library of Babel now. Because my mind runs wild. Like, well, okay, you've already got a subset, right? It's a 410 page with 25 character set here. So it's already a limited number of infinity. You can further reduce that by examining history and seeing which of these books accurately describes the events of history. And then limit it to a subset of that as useful information, and then track that somehow into the future and see which books. I don't know. This is a fascinating idea, especially with the concepts of psychohistory and in its predictive power, right? And how you would ever be sure to any degree that one book, one outcome was the one that was really going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, we're not trying to nakedly spoil the show. So even in the spoiler section, I see no reason to tell you what the vault really is, just because, you know, some of you people can't help yourselves. But yeah, I find, like I said, this is a fascinating concept of its own. that like in this vault contains like every permutation possibly that could possibly happen. And the Prime Radiant is like a Rosetta Stone.
Right.
That can kind of point and guide you to like which one, which version of reality is true, or is it the missing puzzle piece that Raish is referring to, that they have faith that it's going to show up.
They're also playing a very dangerous game with book fans. I mean, I don't know, fuck it, right? Because book fans are already not on board with the show to a large degree. And also,
they're a vanishingly small percentage of the human population.
Like, right, yeah. How many people have read this sci-fi novel from 100 years ago? Not a ton.
Yeah.
But they are, like, the people who are fans of Foundation, the novels, some of them are already up in arms, but a lot of them would probably be up in arms if you significantly change the nature of the vault. So I wonder if they're going to do this as like a dual purpose sort of thing. Like, yes, it contains the vault as we know it in the books, but also there's another layer to it, right?
Yeah. Well, especially this, like, the man of the book seems like it's an obvious, like, you just map Harry Seldon right onto that, but he's a dead man.
Yeah.
Traveling through the cosmos in a custom coffin that just happens to look like the vault.
Yeah.
But he's still dead.
Yeah.
He's still dead. Like, unless they're going to resurrect, like I said, I mean,
I mean, they're talking about destruction and rebirth in this episode, so.
I'm telling you, it's Foundation 3 to search for Seldon.
Yeah. We'll see.
We just need Kirk and a Klingon punching themselves over some kind of volcano.
Mm-hmm.
Like the end of the Lord of the Ring.
Can I ask you, do you know how many pages Library of Babel is? Is it 410 pages long? I hope so.
I mean, what would that even mean? Because like, it's surprised it depends on the translation, the width of the pages.
I don't see the length of the scroll. Number. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They padded it. All versions of the Library of Babel are exactly they force it to be 410. So I don't know. I'm excited. I also want to read more about this. I want to see how long it is, because if it's a short story or novella, I might be able to polish this off before the end of the season. So
yeah, for sure.
Especially if it's going to be such an important key to understanding the stuff going forward. Mm-hmm. So God damn it, Goyer giving me homework. Jesus.
I love it. He's introducing me to things that I've not heard of that are fascinating.
Yeah. And that reminds me a lot of like Westworld and The Leftovers, where it's like the shit I learned along the way, just researching into the themes of the episode, the show, was almost as valuable and fun as the show itself.
Yeah. The quest for knowledge, right? It's all in this episode.
It is. It's the most noble endeavor that the human can engage in. I'm just sitting on my ass watching television. Being noble. Do you got anything more to say, or are we going to let these people go?
That's it.
All right. Foundation of baldmove.com to get your feedback in. We'll have a feedback show tomorrow. Also, make sure you put in Goyer, G-O-Y-E-R, if you want to get a question in for David, because we'll be talking to him Friday morning. And please get that to me before Friday morning, because I'll probably get up early and compile it so I get it all ready to go. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate you guys stopping by, giving a listen, sending in your feedback. It makes the show that much better. Can't wait to see what happens next week. And until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.